This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 in Corvallis now. It's 104.3 in Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, Paul Rowland looks at the rise of the national security state and the abuse of surveillance and intelligence gathering with journalism professor Christopher Sampson and constitutional law professor Christopher Pyle.
Particles on the Wall.
An exploration of the effects of nuclear technology on the Pacific Northwest and the world.
Particles on the Wall.
An exhibit of art, literary works, science, and historical memorabilia that describes the human and environmental impact of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Particles on the Wall.
May 3rd through June 14th, second floor gallery in the EcoTrust building.
Particles on the Wall.
Co-sponsored by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and KBOO Community Radio.
Particles on the Wall.
Information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, Portland, Oregon. My name is Paul Rowan. This is Political Perspectives. And you were just listening to Judas Priest, a song called The Hellion / The Electric Eye. Seemed very appropriate. And we're going to have a couple guests this morning, Christopher Pyle and Christopher Simpson, and we'll be talking about them. Everybody's talking about Edward Snow, electronic surveillance, the National Security Agency. In fact, there will be more discussion coming up here on KBOO this morning on that very subject. So what I was hoping to do was give a little more historical perspective on the subject, now that finally some kind of public debate has been opened up with this really amazing action by this young 29-year-old man, Edward Snowden, who just came out of nowhere and has opened up a worldwide discussion on all kinds of fundamental questions: government monitoring of its own and other populations, secrecy, the confluence of technology, corporate power, and the national security state. I did call this program The Rise of the National Security State and the Abuse of Surveillance Intelligence Gathering because although the scope of what we're talking about here now today with PRISM, the National Security Agency, all these other different government agencies are involved in the surveillance and monitoring and storage of data mining, all these corporate contractors who are now finally coming out of the open a little bit. First and foremost, obviously, Booz Allen Hamilton, which hopefully we'll be talking about some, for which Edward Snowden was an employee. But really, this goes way back. This is not a new thing, although it has really reached new plateaus since 9/11. From the creation of the National Security State in the aftermath of World War II to the FBI's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, to 9/11 and the War on Terror, the use of police and intelligence agencies to monitor people and stifle dissent has continually expanded, aided by technological innovations and increased corporate involvement. So, with that said, we've got, as I said, Christopher Pyle, who teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College. He is the author of Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics and Getting Away with Torture. And we also have Professor Christopher Simpson from American University, who's written quite a few books, one of them Blowback, the first full account of America's recruitment of Nazis and its disastrous effect on the Cold War, and The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, and The Science of Coercion, Communication Research and Psychological Warfare. Those are our guests this morning. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for inviting.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so I guess it's to hopefully get your voices straight for our listeners, I'll start out with Professor Simpson from American University. And I was wondering if you could just sort of talk a little bit about your background and how your interests and your scholarly work and your activist work has led you to have a particular interest in the subject we're discussing.
Well, I've been following the issue of national security state, surveillance, civil liberties, and so forth for 40 years. And have written a number of books about it. Professor Pyle has too. In fact, he's been watching the issue even longer than I have. But the main point is, and I can go through the details of that if you wish, but I think the main point to make is that by understanding the history of this issue, you can see sort of a arc of how it develops and the way it changes over time and the forces that shape it. And so that it, understanding the history makes the present situation more logical in a certain sense, and it also makes it easier to come to grips with the problems involved.
Okay, and I'll ask you the same question, Professor Pyle. I just want to note I also want to note that the way I got in touch with you two is through the Institute for Public Accuracy, which sent out a press release on Monday regarding your article in Counterpunch that appeared on Counterpunch. I'm not sure where else it appeared, called A Profile in Courage. And you came into this perhaps earlier, but according to the press release, you in 1970 disclosed the United States military surveillance of the civil rights and anti-war movements and worked as a consultant to three congressional committees, including the Church Committee, which is going to be an important kind of touch point for our discussion. So maybe you could talk about how you got involved in all this.
Great. But first, I'd like to say thanks for introducing me to Chris Simpson. We've never had the pleasure, but I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
My pleasure, too.
I got into this because I disclosed the Army's surveillance of civilian politics in 1970. I not only disclosed the surveillance, I actually recruited 125 of its agents to tell what they knew about the spying to Congress, the courts, and the press. This led to employment with three congressional committees, as you mentioned, including the Church Committee. And back then, we were actually successful in shutting the U.S. Army Intelligence Command down, and they had to destroy all the files on lawful civilian political activity. But that was a long time ago in another galaxy. The world has changed radically. And today we have a much more extensive surveillance apparatus driven by the power of Googling computers. And we have a vast secrecy organization throughout the government with supporters on Capitol Hill who get campaign contributions from companies like Booz Allen and therefore have limited motivation to check the abuse of these powers by those companies, which are now employed extensively by the intelligence community. And one thing I hope that all your listeners will understand is that 70% of the intelligence community's humongous budget is now spent on private corporations like the one that employed Ed Snowden. And these corporations have capabilities for surveillance now, funded by the government, which they can use to get themselves still more contracts from the government and tax exemptions and such, and in the process, inspire members of Congress, including members of the Intelligence Committee, to look the other way. And that's the big difference from when I worked in Congress. Back then, we had members of both parties who were willing to take the hard questions into account. Today, that's much less likely.
So we're talking really about, like, so many different issues that we're faced with today, whether it's the power of the petrochemical industry worldwide, which is preventing any real action on climate change or addressing the disastrous impacts, as was discussed on the call-in show this morning, the talk radio show on coal in the Northwest or mountaintop removal mining in the Appalachians or fracking, all these, you know, disastrous extreme extraction methods are obviously driven by the power of corporations to maintain those in place, and you can just go down the list. So the rise of corporate power is a really key piece of this puzzle. And also the rise of, you know, the increased power of the national security state since the time of the Church Committee, as you said, had some limits put in place, but they've been gradually eroded, and then 9/11 kind of blew them all out of the water, seemingly. Okay, with those in mind, I'd like to go back before we have a little bit of discussion on the rise of the national security state in the aftermath of World War II, which I think is a really key historical point. I just found some interesting stuff Googling Booz Allen Hamilton. Edwin Booz actually was a very significant figure in the rise of consultant companies. He was a really crucial figure. He, after he graduated from Northwestern University in 1914, he developed the business theory that companies would be more successful if they could call on someone outside their own organization for expert, impartial advice. This theory developed into a new profession, management consulting, and the firm that would bear his name. And he was also the first to combine work for the military, for the government, and the military and private business, because he actually went to work. He was in the Army starting in 1970 and he was called on by the War Department to reorganize and perfect the business methods of various bureaus. And then when he left the Army in 1919, he turned his business acumen to the service of bankers, manufacturers, ad agencies, wholesalers, sales managers, publishers, real estate operators, et cetera. It's focused on identifying and recommending solutions to business problems. And then he went back to work for the Army, for the U.S. Secretary of Navy, to help the Navy prepare for war, thus beginning what turned out to be Booz Allen's long-term and continuing service to the federal government. It's very interesting to look at the history of some of these corporations that are involved in these things. The confluence of corporate power and government control is obviously amped up recently, but obviously it has deep antecedents. So with that in mind, maybe you'd want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about the rise of the national security state itself as we now know it today with the National Security Act of 1947. Would either of you like to address that?
Sure. But first on your Booz Allen Hamilton point, I think there's two things that can be drawn from that. First of all, that the root of the problem that we're facing today is rooted in the system itself. We're not talking about a rogue band of agents. We're not talking about a Dick Cheney sort of figure of evil who is responsible for everything. This is the organic or natural, quote-unquote, natural workings of this system. That's point one. And it has been, in one form or another, for quite some time. The other point is that as early as the 1920s, here's this man, Booz, who recognizes that corporations are incapable of policing themselves or of reforming themselves. So he creates a corporation or a consultancy of his own that goes out and serves these companies. So the point being here is that we're increasingly wrapped up in a corporate intelligence military state that people tend to call the national security state, on the one hand, and as almost 100 years ago, it was already obvious that the corporations that play such a powerful financial role in politics, for example, are not capable of reforming their own behavior.
And so jump up to the National Security Act of 1947.
Sure. Well, Chris, do you want to do this one?
No, go ahead. You're doing very well.
Okay. Well, in the wake of World War II, there's kind of a funny backstory here, is that Franklin Roosevelt, who was the president during World War II, had a great affinity for the Office of Strategic Services, which was a predecessor to the modern CIA. And the Office of Strategic Services was led largely by Wall Street lawyers who had been friends with Franklin Roosevelt. So the OSS had a significant role in World War II. But when the next president came along, Harry Truman, he was very distrustful of the OSS and disbanded it mostly. Also, a lot of the Army intelligence was demobilized. Now, one thing that wasn't demobilized that is worth keeping an eye on is what was then the Army Security Service, which was the Signals Interception Service. And that is what, in another half a decade or so, became the National Security Agency. All right. Well, so in 1947, Truman, as president, and the intelligence community came up with a new formulation of how U.S. intelligence would work in the aftermath of World War II. And the key idea there is that there would be a central intelligence agency that would centralize the whole process of analyzing intelligence and present it to the president both directly and through a National Security Council that was made up of senior cabinet officers and then had its own staff and so on. So the whole idea there was to professionalize, streamline, make more coherent in a business sense or in an organizational sense the process of arriving at national security policy. That is what the 1947 National Security Act did and established and created a special zone, if you will, in a special administrative or bureaucratic zone that advised the president that was outside of the realm of the previously existing bureaucracy. And just a point, side point here is that, at least for me, observing how these bureaucracies work offers a lot of different insights into how intelligence works. So anyway, 1947, National Security Act. There were a number of other acts at that same time. We could discuss those if you want. But the main thing is a reform of the national security apparatus and a tighter coordination on the part of that policy process.
Okay, and so it seems like kind of a key question, key issue, sort of telescoping really drastically modern history here, since the last 100 years and post-World War II, is, you know, post-World War II, the expansion of United States military and economic power, the extension of United States influence around the world, the expansion of U.S.-based corporate control and activity around the world, and the opening up of markets, all those things, and the whole expansion of United States, just the entire, you know, foreign service apparatus, all that. And that has, you know, led to, and then the role of the CIA in a lot of these coups, whether we're talking about Guatemala, Iran, all this, the behind-the-scenes activity that these intelligence agencies were so involved in. Okay, so jump forward then to the 1960s and the sort of a counter-challenge, worldwide counter-challenge to this framework, which happened to various degrees of success or popular support around the world. Obviously, in the 1960s, the United States, with the Vietnam War going on, with civil rights, many other things going on, was a major deal. And these agencies, the FBI and others, were heavily involved in surveilling United States citizenry. And so that's something that you came in on, Professor Pyle, so we can talk about the Church Committee as opening up, finally bringing up maybe kind of like what's happening today, opening up a public debate on that.
Yes, well, that was really what was remarkable about the 1970s. It was a rather unusual moment in American history where there was popular support for investigating the government, and there were at least a few members of Congress who did not feel personally vulnerable to reprisal by the intelligence agencies and their associated corporations. And that made a big difference. The Church Committee, for which I worked, was a bipartisan committee. The Republican and Democratic staffers worked easily with each other. And yes, the Republicans and Democrats had different political motivations. One wanted to blame the Republicans, the other wanted to blame the Democrats, but they found a way to get over that because there was plenty of blame to go all around. But the chief blame, and Chris has just pointed this out, is in the autonomous nature of these very large bureaucracies, which, because their activities are so complex and because they have plausible claims to keep things secret, and therefore accuse anybody who investigates too far of being a traitor, of helping the enemy, they have been able to function without much accountability. Now, we had a bit of accountability under the Church Committee, but I wouldn't want to exaggerate that. We had a little bit of accountability in the courts, but I wouldn't exaggerate that either. And the important historical fact is that since the 1970s, it's all been downhill. And the courts have chosen not to exercise much constitutional review over these bureaucracies. And members of Congress have been less and less interested in oversight activities. There's very little money to be made as a congressman needing to raise campaign money in investigating executive agencies. Once in a while, you can get some political traction, as Frank Church did. But for the most part, the money is to be made by helping corporations get contracts from the government, helping to operate beneath the radar of most citizens, and without concern for the long-term implications on constitutional law that these special deals entail. And that's what I hope we'll begin to start investigating, is this vast, vast army of corporations that now serve the intelligence community. 33 new buildings have gone up in the Washington, D.C. area since 2007, 2008. They all contain intelligence servicing agencies like Booz Allen, the only construction that's really gone on in Washington, the only contribution to the D.C. economy has been this huge growth in the intelligence community. And most Americans don't understand that or understand what its implications are. They think it's just about their privacy, and they'll put everything out on Facebook, so they're not worried about privacy. That's a gross misunderstanding of the problem. The problem here is that newspaper reporters and their sources and crusading congressmen can now be compromised by the surveillance work of the government and these agents, government and these corporations. You may remember that Governor Elliot Spitzer was driven from office because it was disclosed that he had laundered some money to pay some call girls. That was leaked by one of these data mining organizations that happened to be located in the Treasury Department. They came across it in the course of investigation, and they couldn't resist, like J. Edgar Hoover sometimes couldn't resist, leaking the information. Well, what that did was to deprive us of a crusading governor who, as Attorney General, had investigated Wall Street and its many crimes against our retirement programs and our mortgages.
So who controls this vast apparatus has an immense amount of power, not just over the citizenry, but over the political process, over politicians, over everybody who might, you know, have a different approach to what they're trying to do.
Yes, but as Chris would tell you, nobody needs to be in control. These bureaucracies will do these things on themselves. Nobody apparently ordered the Treasury Department to leak that information. Nobody would need to tell Booz Allen's Security Department and others that they could, or lobbyists, that they could use confidential information to influence a member of Congress to vote their way or to look the other way. This can go on quite apart from the president, from his staff, from the oversight committees. This has a life all its own.
That's almost more frightening, that there's sort of an autonomized machinery that's come in place, sort of like HAL in 2001, the computer, if anybody remembers that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Should be.
Well, yeah, and the whole HAL thing is in retrospect, really quite amusing in its own way. I mean, call it up on YouTube or something and have a look at the interchange where HAL, the computer, tells Dave, the human, you know, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that." You know, it can't turn itself off. I think there are leverage points in which democracy still plays an important role. And it's more and more difficult all the time. It's because the formalities of democracy, for example, election of senators or even election of the president, can actually conceal the depth of the problem. One of the Democratic, small d Democratic here, not the Democratic Party, leverage points has to do with campaign financing. The enormous pull of the corporations that Chris Pyle was talking about is driven, at least in part, as he pointed out, by the need to raise campaign cash. And I'd have to look up the exact numbers, but I do recall that the Center for Public Integrity some years ago put out a study in which they determined that a senator in a modern Senate race had to raise something on the order of $15,000 per day, in order to have enough money to buy the television time, the radio time, the campaign materials, the intelligence on their own electorate, how they vote, where they live, all that kind of stuff, to run an effective campaign. $15,000 a day. All right, well, you start thinking about that, and for the first $15,000, well, all right, there's a lot of wealthy people in the country, that's not very much. Then the second day, then the third day, then the 100th day, now you're up to $150,000. On the 200th day, 300th day, so forth and so on, $15,000 a day. And pretty soon, you run out of actual voters who are willing to make those kind of contributions, and you get back to the places in society, both the individuals and the corporations of one form or another, that have that kind of money. So wooing those people becomes a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job for senators and congressmen. That's who they hang out with. That's who they have to appeal to in order to pay the bills that's necessary to stay in office. That is extremely compromising. And it becomes a whole culture of compromise. So that's one leverage point, is bringing that system of how the politicians get paid for, bringing that to light and into public consciousness, not just public cynicism, but public consciousness as a problem to be solved. Another issue, another leverage point that goes exactly to the NSA discussion has to do with accountability for these agencies. What is their budget? How many people do they employ? How do they spend their money? What are the flaws in what they do? What are the actual results of what they do? And I'm not talking about disclosing every possible secret that the NSA has, various technologies, so forth and so on. I'm talking about the most elementary kind of accountability for taxpayer money spent. And getting that sort of thing out of the darkness and onto into the public arena, not only does it not compromise sources, it makes the whole operation far more accountable and far less it's sort of an insulated, almost cult-like atmosphere in which it operates, which frankly is not very effective, even from the standpoint of the NSA itself.
Okay, I want to explore that last point you made a little bit further. But first, we're going to go to a little musical break. This is Political Perspectives here on your community radio station, KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. My name is Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with Professor Christopher Pyle from Mount Holyoke College and Christopher Simpson, a journalism professor at American University in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
We'll be right back.
And we're back. Again, my name is Paul Rowland. This is Political Perspectives here on KBOO Community Radio. And I just couldn't resist playing that. Amy Goodman played that, talking about the same theme yesterday, and I just thought it went really well, especially since we're talking about how the computer in 2001 and the immense technological capabilities that have been developed to control, to monitor, surveil, data mine, store all this information. And I'd like to just mention that new center that was opened up in Utah, the National Security Administration, whatever, data storage center, whatever it's called, apparently just an immense facility, which basically just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, takes in this information and stores it for what use. And it's really interesting, this debate. I've been listening to all different media sources, different blogs, National Public Radio, right-wing talk shows. It just seems like it's stirred up a hornet's nest. People are just, it's sort of, I mean, I think there's a great value in that. I think people are sort of scrambling. You just hear, it's people are all over the map on this, and it's really forcing people to either come to grips with it in some way, or deny, or distract, or deflect in various different ways this issue, which, you know, talk about an elephant in the room. This immense capacity to surveil the citizenry is really just something that's really difficult to think about. But the last thing you were saying, Professor Simpson, about the effectiveness. I mean, is it possible that just the vastness and complexity of all these mechanisms and just the involvement of so many different agencies, despite the continuing attempt to centralize things with the director, you know, the new director of national intelligence from the Patriot Act, Homeland Security from the Homeland Security Act, is it possible that the effectiveness itself is diminished by the extent of all this?
Absolutely. And that is, it's where to begin. That we know that that is the case because one of the most pervasive problems of the federal government for quite some time now has been overclassification of information. And so you have a situation in which both more information is classified, so much information is classified that it undermines actually doing the job of the federal government. And so what happens is that people in the federal government will sometimes leak, find ways around, you know, make sort of solutions to the situations they face in order to overcome the obstacles that the federal government's own policies create. Now, the right wing likes to blame this on too much regulation. It's not that that's entirely untrue, but I think it misses the point. What is happening here is that the government's own structures fail to be accountable not only to the general population, but to even the government itself. And if you think about governments over time, you'll note that this is a long-standing problem. This is not unique to the present century. This has been characteristic of governments, since the age of the kings. Anyway, the point being is that yes, this can and is a serious block to the security that they claim that they're trying to create.
And I'd like to put in a little plug for Counterpunch. As I mentioned, Professor Pyle, you had this article about Snowden, A Profile in Courage, a couple days ago. And there's been just a slew of really good articles. I mean, there's a lot of sites. There's Salon. There's a number of other sites that have a lot of good information. But I find that Counterpunch has really been hitting this issue really well recently. That's counterpunch.org. And there was one article that really struck me. It was called, I think, What is the Government's Real Agenda? I'd just like to read a little bit from that article, which really gave me a lot of food for thought. What is the government's real agenda? Clearly, the, quote, war on terror is a front for an undeclared agenda. In, quote, Freedom and Democracy America, citizens have no idea what their government's motives are in fomenting endless wars and a Gestapo police state. Germans in the Third Reich and Soviet citizens in the Stalin era had a better idea of their government's agenda than do, quote, Freedom and Democracy Americans today. The American people are the most uninformed people in modern history. In America, there is no democracy that holds government accountable. And I would like to give you, Professor Pyle, an opportunity to kind of address that. And we talked about this idea of the autonomization of these processes, the technology involved, the, you know, these super secret, you know, autonomous agencies that are kind of operate in secrecy. But, you know, who's, you know, is there any real, what's really going on? What's the goal of all this? It just seems, of course, corporate profit, corporate power, you know, obviously politicians maintaining their power, but it just seems to be a rudderless ship at this point.
Well, that may be a very good metaphor, or a ship with many rudders, not all working in the same direction. I don't think that it helps to imply that there's something nefarious behind all of this. It can grow into that. I was on Nixon's enemies list, but I never found anything terribly nefarious about that. I found a form of reprisal, but it wasn't terribly nefarious. The problem is, as Chris has pointed out, is that these giant bureaucracies are like organisms that cannot stand dissent within their body politic. They turn on dissenters, leakers, whistleblowers. Virtually all whistleblowers suffer and suffer substantially when they criticize their bureaucracies. That occurs in corporations as well in the government, and people need to understand that. I think they do understand it. That's why they don't whistleblow. But what we're seeing now in the attacks on Ed Snowden are attempts to make him go away or distract us from the failings or the abuses of those bureaucracies. And we need to get our focus back on what's important. And it's not anybody's motives, Ed's motives or the intelligence people's motives, except for this desire of all surveillance bureaucracies to do more surveillance. Bureaucracies are a solution in search of a problem. They will redefine any situation in society as requiring surveillance in order to keep themselves employed and to expand their bureaucracy.
So is it
we need to understand.
And I think he's making an excellent point there. And part of it, this whole concept of redefinition of the need for surveillance in new circumstances. And as each new technological development comes along, each new technological opportunity, that is a new opportunity for a particular bureaucracy to expand its influence within the broader community of bureaucracies, if you will, that are also, in an almost entrepreneurial sense, attempting to expand their influence. So what do we see happening, for example, in the national security state right now? Great expansion of intelligence bureaucracies and special operations bureaucracies. Contraction of conventional armed forces. Why? Well, it's because they're enormously expensive. So along comes a new entrepreneur on the block, the Special Operations Command, in this particular example, and says, in essence, to the more senior levels of the national security apparatus, we can do that same job for half the cost, or whatever the numbers are. And so they now are the growing entrepreneurs of government security, and the conventional Army, conventional Navy, and so forth are facing cuts in their budgets. same basic pattern when it comes to outside of government contractors. Now, you can call this, I'm struggling with, you know, what name to give this. And one, of course, you know, you have a variety of different points of view as to what name to give it. Some people blame it on capitalism. Some people blame it on imperialism. The Catholic Church even is very critical of this and blame it on a lack of religiosity and so forth and so on. So there's a variety of different approaches to how do you attribute blame for this kind of this clash of entrepreneurial bureaucracies. One way to look at it is, well, I'm getting too philosophical here, but just to finish up the point, and that is philosophers, even very mainstream philosophers, back at the turn of the previous century, had this idea that the system creates a shell or a cage in which we as human beings are trapped, and the cage actually adjusts itself or modifies itself as the world changes. And frankly, I see something like that happening here. Now, when you get to the specifics of the NSA situation, what you see happening is that the prejudices of that bureaucracy or the preconceptions of that bureaucracy are built in to the mathematical equations, the algorithms that are used to search these telephone records. The prejudice or the assumption in favor of surveillance and in favor of identifying guilty parties, whether or not they're actually guilty or not is a different question. That is built into the math that is used in what Chris Pyle called Google-style computing, that's used to detect suspects in the NSA's program.
Yeah, Amy Goodman's first guest on Democracy Now! This morning was making the point it's really disingenuous that people are sort of saying, oh, well, they're not taping anyone's phone calls, there's no content, and made the really strong point that actually it's quite possible that the data being gotten by location of phone calls, by, you know, who called who, by a whole series of information that you can glean, and then compiling all that together, as you say, with these algorithms, is actually, you can glean more information, and it's actually more dangerous, and leads to the possibility of entrapping people that really are completely innocent, completely outside of whatever investigation is going on, or intentionally snaring people for political purposes and for stifling dissent, et cetera.
Well, I think that's one of the things that Chris Pyle was able to document in an earlier generation at the Church Committee, the presumption of guilt rather than the presumption of innocence. Is that true, Chris?
Yes. I'll give you one example. The general who put me on Nixon's enemies list did so because he thought that my disclosures of his operations couldn't have been done by a graduate student. They had to have been done by an agent of a foreign power. And so he told his staff that I must be working for the Chi-Coms, the Chinese Communists, when any idiot could have figured out that I was living on the GI Bill. They were paying me to investigate them. But he had, as you say, that preconception in his head. Now, it was an anti-communist preconception. Today, it is an anti-terrorist preconception. But when you can't find a terrorist, because there aren't that many going around, you then turn groups like PETA, the group that protects animals, or the Quakers, into crypto-terrorists.
Or the Occupy movement.
Yeah, and that keeps full employment for your bureaucracy. And this is what's going on in the fusion centers around the country and in a number of corporate security offices. They are taking ordinary political dissent and redesigning it as potential terrorism. because they might have a demonstration.
Yeah, really, these fusion centers are just COINTELPRO under another name, right?
Well, they're not COINTELPRO yet because most of them are not terribly operational. They're not out there framing people or attacking them or undermining them directly. But they have that capability. They could grow into that, as police red squads did in the previous generation. But most Americans don't have a clue that we're creating these vast bureaucracies with the need to get more and more money to pay their employees, so they keep hyping the threat. And this all distracts us from the really important work of investigating those few very dangerous terrorists.
Chris Simpson, you wanted to add something?
Well, I think he's hit the nail on the head. Going back to the historical theme that we began the program with, we got it up to the 1970s. I think the Reagan administration was a good example of how officially benign intelligence operations can be quite easily and quite rapidly turned into programs that are designed to conduct warfare, either against a foreign population, like in the case of Nicaragua, for example, or in the case or domestic operations of one sort or another that are aimed at discrediting, eliminating as political factors through whatever term, whatever means are necessary, the various local or domestic opponents that an administration has or that a bureaucracy has. That was very well documented in terms of the Iran-Contra affair. Most people don't, or many young folks today, it's all ancient history. But what it really came down to is that you had people in the National Security Council who cut deals with drug traffickers in Latin America to bankroll a civil war in particularly in Nicaragua, but also other types of really very brutal activities throughout Central America and in other parts of the world.
And I don't think we really have time. We only have about 5 minutes left, but I did actually forget about the timeline there and wanted to talk about 9/11 and the Patriot Act and Homeland Security and all that. But since you brought up the Iran-Contra, you probably know about this woman, Sybil Edmonds, and this thing they call Gladio B, which seems to be something very similar, where they're using these Mujahideen people to carry out similar things to what Gladio did, which was this paramilitary anti-communist formations in Western Europe recruiting. This is something you've written about, Chris Simpson, the recruitment of Nazis and fascists for the anti-communist sort of secret anti-communist war during the Cold War era, and leading up. And it seems to, in a way, possibly lead up to 9/11 itself, with the creation of Al-Qaeda basically sort of coming out of some of these people that had been recruited by the CIA in the United States.
Well, I resist calling it Gladio B because I think that kind of confuses the discussion.
Well, that's what they call it.
Yeah, right. But what is happening is a standard operating procedure of clandestine operations. It's not like some weird thing that was just thought up in this generation. This goes way back. Empires solicit dissident people in their opponents' organization, in their opponents' nationalities, among their opponents' nationalities, in order to do sabotage and insurgency against their opponents. The British did it, French did it, Germans did it in World War II, the Americans have done it since at least the turn of the century, and arguably sooner. I'm talking about the 1900s to the 19th century to the 20th century. It's absolutely standard operating procedure. That's what special forces do. That's what they're paid to do.
And it leads to this whole cult of secrecy, and the expansion of the national security state.
Yes.
Which is what we're talking about. So any last thoughts? You want to try to wrap it up? We, you know, obviously we tried to take on quite a bit here in this hour, the rise of the national security state and the abuse of surveillance and intelligence gathering. Where to go from here? I mean, is what do you see? Do you see more whistleblowers coming forward? Is Edward Snowden and a shining example that you think other people are going to follow?
I don't know if they will. I hope they will. But I hope if they do it, they'll be very responsible, be very focused, and not try to make all the judgments themselves, but to work with responsible people in journalism and in academia to very carefully disclose that information, preferably in an unclassified form, and in ways, of course, that do not endanger the lives, careers of government personnel, particularly the clandestine ones.
And do you feel Edward's
die in this process? But this can be done. It is possible to find ways to declassify most of this stuff and to get it into the public debate. But as I think Chris agrees, one thing we're going to have to do is to control campaign financing if we're ever to get Congress back on track. When I worked in Congress, we had 7,500 committee meetings a year. We're now down to 2,500. And most of those have nothing to do with oversight. So Congress is asleep at the switch, and the situations have only gotten more dangerous.
And Professor Simpson?
Well, I think Chris has hit the nail on the head. I think that there's just as there's this type of darkness out there that we've been discussing, there's also a great deal of hope out there. I think the Occupy movement, the Arab Spring, the struggles that are going on in other countries, the struggles that are going on in our country, are all signs that that people want democracy. They want accountability, and they're willing to make sacrifices to get it. And I think that that's fundamentally a healthy thing. Right now, we've got a particular crisis that's in the news that has to do with the role of technology in all this. And I think that our conversation today is an important one, and one part of an ongoing process by which people, I'm talking about millions of people now, come to grips with the reality of the situation that they find themselves in. And I think that fundamentally that's a good thing. So we'll leave it at that. I think there's great possibilities today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to wrap it up there. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Political Perspectives here on Community Radio, KBOO. I've been speaking with Professor Christopher Simpson from American University and Christopher Pyle from Mount Holyoke College. Thank you both for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and our new frequency, 104.3 in Philomath and Corvallis. 104.3, Philomath, Corvallis. The time is 9:59, coming up on 10 o'clock straight up right now. Coming up next, Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints. And at 11, The Dirtbag with your host, Glenn Andreessen.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food, and a beer garden, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy as well. Hump Day PDX is June 12th, from 6 to 10 p.m., and every second Wednesday of the month thereafter, at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information.